Welcome to Looking at Lucasfilm, the podcast with a different perspective on the world of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and all of the other entities that George Lucas, Kathleen Kennedy, and the rest of the team of Lucasfilm have been dreaming up for us for the past 40 years. I'm entertainment writer Jim Hill, and my co-host, the one and only Dan Z. We're recording this on Wednesday, January 8th, 2020. A day that's kind of significant, at least here at the Hill House, because this afternoon, Nancy and I finally got around to seeing Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker.
I'm so glad. I like that. I never thought of it as the Hill House. Sounds like a haunted house.
Well, it's actually the down at the road, we literally, that the sign says Statler Hill. And, you know, the interesting thing is that there's a lot of people who come up the driveway because they think it's a street name rather than a house name.
Sure.
But anyway, so again, I am kind of embarrassed that it took almost 3 weeks. And in fact, since you saw it at the premiere, it's been a full 3 weeks since you've seen this thing. And
yeah,
how many times have you seen it now?
It's still four.
Yeah. Four. Okay. Because I do feel like I really have to go back, and not just because I fell asleep for about 5 minutes in the whole Zori Bliss section, but we'll get to that.
That's probably a good place to fall asleep if you're going to fall asleep. Geez. I don't mean as a pejorative, but I mean, if you had to pick one section, that might be it.
Okay. Well, somehow I don't think that's going to be the pull quote for the box, Dan, but
probably not. You know,
probably not. But tell you what, folks, Dan and I will finally discuss in depth The Rise of Skywalker in the second half of today's show. Just a warning, though, folks, that there will be spoilers. But before that, Dan, let's get to the news. So I have to ask, did you see the tweet that John Kasdan put out on Monday?
Was it with the picture?
With the picture.
I sure did.
Okay, so we've been talking about this for a while, that the Willow, now again, I got to caution folks that this is not saying that Disney Plus is actually making a Willow limited series. What's happening here is they're going to shoot the pilot. And based on the strength of the pilot, you know, again, it's going to get shown to Disney, both Disney corporate as well as the folks over at, you know, again, the new subscription service. And if it's strong enough, it will then, evidently, it's kind of the Mandalorian business plan. It's going to be 6 to 8 episodes. And with the hope that, you know, again, you know, Alora Dannon, was that the name of the baby? You know, so there's already a tradition now, you know, that there was a baby in Willow. So, you know, I don't think Baby Yoda can show up in this one, though.
Probably not.
But yeah, it's at least a go at this point. And, you know, and again, you, Dan, we talked about this previously. You got to see it in theaters, or did you have to wait for VHS?
I saw Willow in theaters, and it is the first and only time I've seen the movie. So it's been a hot minute or two.
Okay. If it's up to me, you know, the one thing I'd really love to see John fold into this thing is the return of, I think the characters' name are Rule and Frangin. They're the brownies that Kevin Pollak and Rick Overton played in the film. And Kevin's out there. I mean, Kevin is actually part of the ensemble of The Marvelous Miss Maisel.
Mrs. Maisel, that's right, which is, for my money, the absolute best show on TV and anywhere.
It is pretty amazing. As a fan of 60s stand-up, and in fact, that for me is half the charm of the show, is how hard and how well they depict, you know, how life is in the early 1960s or thereabouts.
Sure.
It's great, great fun. And in fact, didn't that just get picked up for season 4 as well?
It sure did. Okay.
All right, moving on now. Dan, again, every time I talk to you, you're either getting on a plane or getting off a plane.
I know.
Now, are you going to the Rise of the Resistance opening at Disneyland later this month?
I am not. I got invited, and despite what Drew Taylor says, I got invited to the one in Florida, too. Mm-hmm. But because of my day job, I can't. It's harder for me to go away unless it's during summer or Christmas. But no, I am not. I wish I was.
Well, and for those of you who haven't heard, that's the Anaheim version of Rise of Resistance is opening on January 17th. And let's face it, Dan, we've actually talked about this in the show. Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, when it opened in Anaheim back on May 31st, had kind of a weird summer. And you know, if you talk with folks in themed entertainment, they lay the blame for this largely at the feet of the Disneyland Resort, which, remember, spent all of that time talking about how they're making changes to the park because there were going to be these giant crowds. And in effect, they scared a lot of people away. They didn't come out for the first summer. But the interesting thing with the Rise of the Resistance opening in what, just 9 days?
Yeah.
They get a chance, you know, this the rare upon rare thing, a second chance to make a first impression. And so what Disneyland's decided to do to completely bury the needle in the other direction, you know, there won't be any pictures of an empty Black Spire outpost because Disney has just announced this ticket offer where it's, what is it? You have to buy, it's a 3-day ticket and it's a one park per day. So, you know, you have to commit to whether or not you're going to Disneyland Park or California Adventure. But Dan, it's $67 a day. And that, you know, especially if you're bringing kids 3 to 9 to the park, that's $100 savings.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
Well, more to the point, that virtually guarantees that come the 17th or the weekend of the 18th or the 19th, you know, the internet is going to be flooded with these photos of you know, lines that go all the way down to Knott's Berry Farm, you know, just that, you know, that many people trying to get into the park to take advantage, and not only to ride this amazing new attraction, but also, you know, to take advantage of this very incredibly low ticket price to get into the Disneyland park. By the way, I guess I should mention, I was talking with both Len about it and as well as some park insiders, and they've had a couple of bad days. I won't lie to you about the Rise of the Resistance in Florida, but overall, the numbers are ramping up. They're getting more and more boarding groups in per day. You know, the ride has. They've gotten to a point where they've kind of stabilized it. It's still something of a science project because it is so ridiculously ambitious. But the interesting thing is that everything they've learned in Orlando, they're passing along the pipeline to Anaheim. So the hope is that, you know, when the Anaheim version runs, it'll be that much smoother than the version that opened at Disney's Hollywood Studios back on, what was that, December 5th?
Sounds right. Yeah.
Okay. So, again,
good news for the West Coast, because that park deserves to be oversaturated with people, because this is one of the most amazing things you can experience in any theme park.
Well, that's what I keep hearing, that it is, you know, the most amazing attraction. And again, looking forward to getting down and experiencing it myself later this winter in Orlando. But
you honestly aren't going to ever hear anyone come off that attraction for the first time and go, oh, it was okay. That's never going to happen. It's never going to happen.
Okay. You know, somebody's going to take that bet. Now, you know, mind you, they'll have to put on a blindfold and wear earplugs.
They'll
you
be
know,
dishonest. But, yeah, it's amazing.
There we go. You know, so, well, you know, switching now to the publishing side of things. Okay, Dan, I think we talked about this, that back in February of last year, Dark Horse and Lucasfilm announced that they were going to be publishing The Art of Star Wars Rebels. This is a book that was going to be written by Dan Wallace, a 208-page hardcover featuring exclusive commentary by Dave Filoni, Simon Kinberg, and Carrie Beck. And I know you and I, because we both love this show, immediately put this on, you know, our, okay, got to get that.
Yes.
And it was originally supposed to hit store shelves on October 1st of last year. Then quietly, literally like a week or two before it was supposed to actually hit store shelves, the publication date suddenly got pushed back to April 28th of 2020. What gives? For a lot of particularly art books, your typical coffee table book, which these days, to save costs, a lot of publishers publish them overseas, particularly in China. And given the tariff situation, a lot of the books had trouble getting into the States on the original delivery dates. But sometimes, on the other hand, a publication date will get changed because, for example, an art of book for a film, because the people who've made the movie want to keep information under wraps for a while. I mean, case in point, the art of Star Wars Episode IX, The Rise of Skywalker. That book was originally supposed to show up. Abrams is publishing that. That was supposed to show up on December 18th, 2 days before that J.J. Abrams movie showed up in theaters. But then on December 10th, Abrams announced that they were pushing back the publication of The Art of Star Wars Rise of Skywalker till the spring of 2020, specifically March 31st of this year. And that was supposedly done at Disney's request because they didn't want certain spoilers, Palpatine, to get out early. So what does this have to do with the art of Dark Horse's Art of Star Wars Rebels book? I mean, you can't spoil the story of a show that screened its last episode back in March of 2018, right, Dan?
That's right. That's right. I was there in the room.
Yeah. I mean, again, four wonderful seasons, great storytelling. But the story of Ezra Bridger and the crew of the Ghost, it's over, right?
You're killing me.
Well, this is, but think about it. This is exactly what fans of Star Wars, the Clone Wars animated series thought, that the last set of that episode of that show had, once they became available for streaming on Netflix back in March of 2014, that show was over. But then came the announcement in San Diego Comic-Con back July of 2018 that Clone Wars would return for a seventh season on Disney Plus, 12 brand new episodes. By the way, we've actually got a date of when they're going to start streaming, Dan. That's February 17th, next month. And you saw the trailer for the new stuff at Star Wars Celebration last April, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was there.
And did anything particularly leap out at you at that point, or?
There really wasn't anything new or groundbreaking in that, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But correct me if I'm wrong, were you in San Diego to catch when they did the sort of bait and switch there where people thought they were watching a retrospective and suddenly there was new footage in it?
Yeah, I just mentioned a few seconds ago, I was definitely in that room, and it was one of the most electric Star Wars experiences I've ever had.
I cannot wait for this show to come back. But I bring the Clone Wars situation up in relation to the delay of the publication of the Art of Star Wars Rebels because of something that a friend who's working at Disney Television and Animation told me, which is basically that Lucasfilm Animation, which is right now putting the finishing touches on those 12 episodes that it's producing for Disney Plus of Star Wars Clone Wars, is looking to keep the Clone Wars production team together, which is why they're reportedly exploring the idea of reviving Star Wars Rebels. Which, if you think about it, if you think about how that last episode ended, where you had Ahsoka Tano and Sabine getting ready to head off into the unknown regions search of Ezra.
Outer rims in search of Ezra, yeah. and a certain blue skinned moth. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the thinking is that there's still a lot of meat left on that bone. There's a lot of Star Wars related stories to tell. But what's fascinating to me is that supposedly Kevin Feige Remember, Kevin is supposedly been tasked with developing a Star Wars film. And remember, this is the guy who makes, you know, all the movies for Marvel. And, you know, in fact, I think you and I discussed, Dan, that you know, in fact, you were not happy when I shared the rumor that he had supposedly reached out to Samuel L. Jackson about coming back to do Mace Windu.
No, Mace Windu, like Uncle Ben, needs to stay where he is. I mean, honestly, at some point, there is no peril. There is no real threat of loss. Then there's no drama if everyone comes back.
No. I agree with that. I get that. But the interesting thing is, again, you know, working my trap line and talking with friends at Marvel to see if anybody had anything about Kevin and his Star Wars project. And it's like, well, yeah, you know, he still wants Samuel involved in it, but as a supporting character, because, you know, evidently what Kevin has really kind of focused in on is the notion of he wants to do something with Ahsoka Tano, and with a particular eye toward Brie Larson. You know, just with the notion of, well, here's a woman who's carried a $1 billion film for the studio, Captain Marvel, last year. And, you know, wouldn't it be smart? And, you know, more to the point, you know, the hook is, she already worked with, you know, Samuel L. Jackson in that film, you know, he played Nick Fury, and, you know, wouldn't it be fun, you know, there's kind of a funhouse mirror thing to have them paired yet again in, you know, but in the Star Wars project. Just to sort of caution, you know, that I want to be clear here, this is just speculation, a lot of talk at this point. More to the point, evidently Disney, having looked at the, what is it, $1.2 billion that Captain Marvel made, last February or thereabouts, they would really like, you know, if it's all the same to Disney, they'd like Captain Marvel 2. And more to the point, you know, Bob Iger has just talked about how on the heels of the rise of Skywalker, that he'd like to let the Star Wars film franchise rest for a bit so those movies become special again.
I've always loved that idea, as you know.
Yeah. So it's just going to be interesting going forward. Now, in regard to the Star Wars Rebels animated series revival, again, the book, the art of book, hits store shelves on April 28th. But we may not have to wait till then to get word about this, you know, possible continuation of the series. I'm being told that WonderCon is being held in Anaheim this year, April 10th through the 12th, and that Disney Plus is planning on holding a Star Wars Clone Wars panel at that event, and that kind of in the spirit of what happened at San Diego Comic-Con, when they ran that, you know, that footage suddenly revealed new, you know, Clone War footage that, you know, that the... I guess, again, if you're a Star Wars animation fan, this is probably a panel you don't want to miss, not just because evidently they're going to show an episode that hasn't been shown yet of Clone Wars, but also because that there may be some Rebels news coming out of this panel. So
wow. And that's Easter weekend.
Yeah. Now speaking of Star Wars Rebels, all right, so you've seen the film 4 times now.
Yes.
Did I hear correctly that in that scene where, you know, and again, I apologize, folks, we're going to get into spoilers here. But when Rey is sort of gathering her strength, and we hear sort of every Jedi known to man, was that really Freddie Prinze in there as Kanan Jarrus?
It was. It absolutely was.
Wow.
Tremendous. Okay. Yeah, tremendous.
I don't know. I just
love. And you heard Ahsoka Tano too. That's why
we did. We did. Not to get into spoilers here, but that means she's dead, right?
Well, actually, Dave addressed that around Christmas time. He drew a picture of her with Gandalf, and it said no. And it says something like, "No one's ever really gone." So I don't know.
I love that. I love Dave. Okay, we'll tell you what, folks. When we get back from this commercial break, It's finally going to happen. You know, Dan and I are going to do the deep dive on Star Wars Rise of the, Star Wars Rise of Skywalker.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
You're John Chespagon.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back. All right. Now Dan, on our last show, we kind of danced around it because we were trying to be kind to folks who hadn't seen the film yet. And, you know, speaking in somewhat vaguish terms about this J.J. Abrams film. But I just want to warn folks that we're getting into spoiler country here. But you were pretty upfront when we talked last time around about how you liked Rise of Skywalker, but you didn't necessarily love it.
That's correct. I still feel that way, too.
Okay.
If I were to rate the 9 Skywalker films, it would probably be in my bottom 3.
Really?
Yeah.
And what would the other 2 in the bottom 3 be?
Oh, probably Attack of the Clones and Phantom Menace. Hmm. But to be fair, I still love them. I mean, a Star Wars movie that's not as strong as like pizza, even when it's not great, it's better than anything else.
Well, I love that you use the kind of a food analogy, because the same thing. I liked a lot of Rise of Skywalker. Didn't necessarily love it. I on the other hand, instead of pizza, I'd go for the buffet analogy. That, you know, it was quite possible to watch this movie and go, oh, I really like that, and I don't care for this, but I really like that. And I kept finding, you know, that was my experience, that there'd be, you know, a particularly wonderful scene. Well, yes. First and foremost, I think one of the things we have to acknowledge about what they did right is, you know, how many scenes they had, or how many, you know, vignettes in the film that had Rey and Poe and Finn working together. And
it was, you know, that was nice.
Yeah, and because Daisy Ridley, John Boyega, and Oscar Isaacs have such great chemistry and obviously enjoy each other's company, it really lifted a lot of scenes. It made them a lot of fun. And, you know, strictly from, you know, a storytelling point of view, you know, again, look, you know, kind of from The Force Awakens, you knew that, you know, especially if you paid attention during the original trilogy, you knew that Ben Solo was going to eventually be redeemed. But I have to admit, I enjoyed how it was handled.
The amazing thing to me about this entire film is that I was quite staunch in my proclamation that he shouldn't be redeemed. He didn't show any signs, and I guess to be fair, neither did Vader, except for maybe a little bit at the end of The Empire Strikes Back. And so I didn't expect that it would happen, and I didn't expect that if it did, that I would like it. As it turns out, I loved it, and this was my favorite Adam Driver performance of the entire sequel trilogy. I thought that part worked almost to perfection.
Oh, no. And in fact, you know, I especially loved the way the appearance of your good, close personal friend Harrison Ford was handled.
That is, yes.
In fact, I love the callback there with, you know, to classic Han Solo with, I know.
I know. I just got goosebumps when you said that.
Yeah. I mean, actually you talked about it on the last show about the Carrie Fisher scenes and how
weren't they phenomenal? Just a feat of storytelling and ILM magic.
Yeah, I just to be honest, as a cinematic sleight of hand, you know, that again, when you think about how somebody sat in an editing room and, you know, found, you know, I guess they had 8 minutes of footage, you know, and but found the eight line, and more to the point, not just the lines, the line readings, the looks, you know, that sort of thing to make them work. And I think for me, it only came undone with Leia's death. I think, oddly enough, the moment that should have been the most powerful was the weakest, because frankly, I don't think they had the imagery to back up what they were trying to do.
Really? You know, so yeah, I thought that was actually, I know what you're saying. It did seem a bit abrupt.
Yep.
Like, I guess because I thought, because they were moving so smoothly with all of her footage, I thought, well, maybe they're just not going to address it and she's just going to be there. And I would have been so happy with that. In fact, before mm-hmm. the movie, my wife and my brother-in-law and I were all talking about that. And then mm-hmm. she did. But what mm-hmm. I thought was rather poignant is mm-hmm. that they have her body there, and it doesn't mm-hmm. actually disappear until Ben's does at the end. And the fact that it affected me emotionally as much as it did is phenomenal, especially when you consider that Adam Driver and Carrie Fisher shared 0.0 moments on screen together in the sequel trilogy. Yeah. And it still was able to elicit pathos, which I thought was pretty impressive.
No, I agree. And you know, and also we have to talk about the amazing production values, you know, that I mean, huge sets. I loved how many of the creatures and the characters were done practically. You know,
Neil Scanlon.
I know this is kind of a controversial aspect of Rise of Skywalker, but I even enjoyed a lot of the fan service. I mean, it's like when Maz gave Chewie the medal, you know, it's like, I get, okay, that's a little ham-handed, you know, but on the other hand, it is a callback all the way to The New Hope, and we're finally righting a wrong, you know, that was made back in 77.
You know what? Interestingly enough, when I first saw that sequence, it didn't occur to me that he was finally getting his medal. I thought it was more symbolic that he was having, that he had Han's medal. That was what I thought was powerful.
Okay.
Yeah. But I haven't heard anyone really say that, but that's just the part that it grabbed me.
Okay. And even at the same time, I loved, you know, when Rey goes back to Tatooine and is there at you know, Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru's, you know, house, and it, the way she gains entrance is, once again, she slides down on a piece of metal. You know, right. the call back to the first film. I mean, it just, I like that.
And also showing that she still has that childlike innocence and joy that the Emperor was not able to snuff out of her, which is very nice.
This is true. So, I apologize here again for the buffet analogy. But again, there were enough really great, you know, little moments and big set pieces. I mean,
I thought Billy Dee Williams was wonderful.
I have to admit, but at the same, it's interesting you bring up Billy Dee Williams, because again, I have here the Star Wars.
Occult 45? Occult 45?
What did I did? No, I've got a mango iced tea sitting here. But I also have a copy of the Star Wars Rise of Skywalker visual dictionary that DK put together.
Oh, the Papa wrote.
Okay, so you just talked about Lando.
Yep.
And if you turn to page 108 in this thing, they talk about the Hermit. And listen to this description here of the Hermit character, all right? The disenchantment of Pisan can bury many a painful past, or so thought the Hermit would begin his solitude there. Personal tragedy and the failure to find answers on an arduous quest have led him to reside on this arid world. Now,
I find that frustrating.
That's the thing that you know, if you read the support material for this thing, and what is the name of her character again? Hallie.
You're talking about?
Oh, Janna. Janna.
Yeah, Janna. Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's the other thing, that moment that. kind of frustrated me in that last 10 minutes, which, by the way, again, you were right. You know, very enjoyable last 10, you know, strong last 10 minutes of the movie. Mm-hmm. But that little bit of dialogue between Lando and Jana about, you know, where are you from? I don't know. Well, let's find out. And, you know, just what's inferred is that this is Lando's long lost daughter.
And if that is in fact true, and if we also presuppose that the visual guy, which is canonical, I mean, Pablo wrote it, so it's canonical. Mm-hmm. If that's why he's exiled, is he going to be that laid? Is he going to be that laid back if that's actually his daughter in front of him? And he was so upset. I mean, come on. I'm really disappointed in that. That's one of the few missteps I feel like Lucasfilm has done with Star Wars since Disney purchased it.
I would agree, but
it's just weak.
Speaking of missteps, and again, I apologize because to attack this point, really, I mean, literally, it's the first three words of this, you know, the crawl of this film, the dead speak, they did, you know, but to have the Emperor return, I'm sorry, but for me, that just totally negates the Darth Vader sacrifice back in Return of the Jedi. I mean,
I've been thinking about that a lot.
You know, that had weight, that had consequence, and the notion of, you know, what they were, you know, in the 15 seconds before the Death Star built, somebody was down there with a spatula. You know, just how?
I don't. I'm going to assume mm-hmm. that this is a clone. I mean, no one said that. If you'll notice, I'm sure you mm-hmm. did, in the visual guide, there's zero mention of the Emperor.
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of important too. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know if it negates Vader's sacrifice, because he's still, whether the Emperor, I mean, this is kind of redactive anyway, but whether he knew the Emperor was going to die or not, he still gave his life to save his son. So that mm-hmm. that's still intact. No, but I could have done. But the thing about the Emperor that bothers me. Mm-hmm. is who his granddaughter is. That's the part that I'm still not crazy about. And this is the first Star Wars movie where I've had challenges with not the story, but how it is told. That's the part that kind of bothers me. And that's why I've said this is the least J.J. Abrams movie of all the J.J. Abrams movies that I've ever seen, because I just don't feel like that's not tightly constructed enough. I mean, I'm not going to get super upset about it, but and maybe something will happen later that will make it click for me. But quite honestly, it shouldn't have to. The movie should speak for itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, and while, you know, we're talking about problematic aspects of this thing, it's like the giant Final Order fleet, each of these huge ships outfitted with planet killer technology, or for that matter, the stadium filled with Sith worshippers who were there to see. You know, and it's one of these things where it's like overkill doesn't really even begin to kind of describe this. It's just sort of like, you know,
it's too much. It's like a Drew Taylor joke. It's just too much.
Oh, and speaking of too much. Okay. It's the last half hour of The Last Jedi. And, you know, that they're inside of that abandoned mining crate, and the steel door is closed, and Leia puts out the call for help, and nobody comes. And but we now switch to The Rise of Skywalker, and Lando, again, the hermit, who's been in isolation, supposedly, because of his, you know, he lost his daughter or whatever. All right. He puts out the call, and every spaceship on, you know, again, you know, just that line from the movie, they don't have a navy. It's not a navy. It's just people, but it's thousands of people. Did you buy into that at all?
You know, I've thought about that one a lot too. I will say that in the novel Resistance Reborn, they do address why no one shows up at the end of The Last Jedi.
Okay.
So that helps. And because a year has gone on between The Last Jedi and The Rise of Skywalker, it stands to reason with all the things that they've done, in at least in the books, that book and the comics. There's actually a junior novelization, or like a young adult novel as well. Spark of the Resistance, I believe it's called. Those books sort of show how Leia and Rey, and everyone's been going all over the galaxy trying to get people. So in my mind, in the course of a year, they've had time to get frustrated and get courageous and just be ready to take action. Whereas at the end of Last Jedi, I mean, it was the First Order was at the peak of its powers. The challenge for me about that is more that we spent all this time getting invested in the First Order and how dangerous they are, and all of a sudden they're actually not important or relevant. It's actually the Final Order that's the big deal. And suddenly everybody who's been underwater has really nice pressed black and red costumes. That's more confusing to me. And unless like they've just been recruiting and they suddenly showed up. I guess that makes sense. But if you try too hard to find logic in Star Wars or fictional movies, you're going to go down.
I get that. You know, again, you have to remember the source material, and George was, you know, I mean, right up front about that, you know, the Buck Rogers serials from the 1930s, you know, that, you know, so it's, again, and nobody's sitting around, you know, Ming the Merciless would never have worn a jetpack. What are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Just to you. But, okay, a couple other things.
Did that bug you too? The fact that all of a sudden, oh, wait, the First Order doesn't matter. It's actually, you know what I mean? Like, what's the point of being invested in these bad guys if they're suddenly not relevant?
Well, I think, and to sort of connect this to another thing that kind of bugged me, again, in that last 10 minutes, I mean, don't get me wrong, always great to see Warwick Davis, and, you know, just, you know, in fact, was that his son also playing the other that you want?
I think so. I believe okay. So. Yeah.
So, you know, love that. But the notion that we're...
It was actually seeing... Drew, and he wasn't kneeling. That's just how... He's just short.
but I didn't understand why is it that, okay, if this is happening on Exegol, okay, this is happening on Exegol. But why are we cutting away to these other Star Destroyers falling out of the sky that, well, first of all, aren't part of the Final Order? They're First Order. And it's like, at this point in the film, if you're really being tripped up by story logic, you know,
But it's like that, like you said in the last show. I mean, if you show a gun in the first act, it has to fire, and, you know.
I agree.
And so there's just not a lot of context. And that is saying something when you consider that in Star Wars, there's a number of references throughout these movies. Mm-hmm. They refer to things that we never see on screen and are never referred to again, but just gives depth and breadth to the mythology, and it works. And if you can't make it work in that sort of archetype, then you've got some story challenges.
Well, I you of all people, I don't need to talk or explain anything to about story inconsistency. It's sort of like, the line in New Hope when Ben's talking to Luke about, I knew your father, the whole notion of, you lied to me about my father. And it's like, well, you know, the truth is, the way you depend on, I bring that up because, again, according to this movie, Luke and Leia knew about Palpatine this whole time and never mentioned it to Rey.
That actually, I never thought about it from that context until you just mentioned that, but it is very similar to what Obi-Wan did. And as parents, I think I can understand why you'd protect them from such a horrific thing.
I get that. I do.
Mm-hmm. But it is then challenging.
There are complications just for complications, like C-3PO can read Sith, but his programming prevents him from, you know, it's just sort of like, really?
I kind of like that. But I didn't really need, I've already got enough cute little Star Wars things. Babu Frick is adorable, but come on, it's all a child for me. Yeah.
Okay.
Let's talk about Rose, or rather the lack of Rose.
Well, you know, but the weird thing of it is that, again, you and I having talked about, you know, the Rose situation on the last show, I was actually surprised that Rose did have as much to do in the, I mean, you know, if we're talking about sheer line count, you know, she certainly didn't have the sort of, right up front dead center role that she did in The Last Jedi. But if we're talking about, you know, group shots or that sort of thing. I mean, she's definitely part of the team there at the base, and you know, the one and they kept circling back and you know meeting up to, you know, for various story points, but yeah, it's and I say this again, having just watched The Last Jedi before heading out to see The Rise of Skywalker, and it was great to see Finn and Poe and Rey together, but I did miss Rose. And it felt strange that she had such a small part in such a big film.
No, I know. I'm disappointed. I actually said to her at the premiere, mm-hmm. I wish you were in it more.
Mm-hmm.
And she just smiled, and she was so insanely gracious that you would never know. Mm-hmm. But I think that was disappointing, especially because they went out of their way to build up her value in this movie. Now, Star Wars is full again of major characters that don't always have big things to do in all the movies. But I mean, she really was relegated to behind the scenes, and apparently, and I'm sure you've read all the things I have,
mm-hmm.
and definitely probably more. But a lot of her scenes were intended to be with Leia, and mm-hmm. those scenes didn't work because of the footage they had. So that they are mm-hmm. claiming that's why she wasn't in it more.
Got it. And speaking of, you know, you build up a character and then you don't do anything with it. I mean, think about how long, say, as far out as The Force Awakens, we've been talking about the Knights of Rin. You know, supposedly this formidable fighting force, and you know, finally in this film, we kind of get to see them in action. And what they load Chewie on a transport, you know, they stand on top of a butte, and then you know that then Ben Solo kicks their butt. You know,
have you filmed yourself doing the Ben Solo challenge yet?
What is the Ben Solo
challenge? Oh, you haven't seen? Oh, you've got to look it up after the show. It's people. There's all kinds of videos that are getting, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of views of people doing that wonderful moment where Rey puts the saber behind her back and then puts her hands up, and then all of a sudden Ben has it and he kind of does a shrug like Harrison would do.
Yep.
And then he starts to attack. So everyone is doing this. It's caused quite a sensation. Just look for Ben's little challenge. That's great.
I will have to chase this down. Holy
One
cow.
Quick thing before we wrap up, I will say, mm-hmm. That while there are certainly a lot of things that didn't work for me, there are certain moments that are great. The Harrison moment you talked about is one of my favorites in all of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I thought it was wonderful and just perfectly emotional in every way. Kind of like Ben rectifying what happened and riding mm-hmm. the ship in his own mind.
Yep.
But maybe paramount to all of that is, I think this is John Williams' best score of the sequel trilogy. It's wonderful.
Yeah, you know, I have to admit, you know, that there would, you know, and what I loved, you know, for example, you know that moment when Rey was on the crashed Death Star and had made it to the Emperor's throne room, and
yeah,
just that little, you know, and again, it just gave you some idea of what this body of work meant when yes. there was just that little, you know, phrasing from the Darth Vader March, I want to say
Imperial March, yep,
the Imperial March, yeah, and
then that, like, from the throne room sequence in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, I just sort of, and again, it was just sort of like, I love, and let's also be clear here that, you know, in a lot of ways, what J.J. Abrams was attempting to do was impossible. You know, this was to be the ninth film to cap the Star Wars, or the Skywalker saga. And, you know, that there was no way he was going to make everybody happy. There was no way, you know, he was going to be able to hit, you know, every note that every fan wanted. But again, there's, you know, given how much you and I have just criticized this film, the fact that I will still be going out to see this thing in theaters again.
Yeah.
In fact, I was talking with Nancy in the car on the way home. I'm very much looking forward to getting the Blu-ray, the DVR, so I can, you know, for example, the sequence we were talking about, Kanan Jarrus. I want the closed captioning so they can identify each of the Jedi that are talking to her
That'll be
in
fun.
Sequence, you know?
I think that would be great. Yeah, no, I mean, this is, I think this is a good, what you and I just did was a healthy example mm-hmm. of how to disagree mm-hmm. with certain key points in a story or a film or a concept, but still be civil and, you know, try to find pearls because there are plenty of them. I think people get so wrapped up in the negative stuff, but we're not being negative. We're just saying, look, this didn't work for us, but that mm-hmm. that's actually healthy. Again, intellectual honesty and critical thinking, mm-hmm. those are very healthy ways to discuss. And I'm proud of us. I thought we handled that pretty well.
Well, good. And again, I love that you use the term pearls, because again, if I were describing this film, in the end, it is a necklace. I mean, just that there's enough entertainment here that I went out, got to the theater, I had a good time, and I'm going back to see it again.
Yeah, I wouldn't have seen it four times if I didn't love it. There's certain things that are quite great, and the last thing with Rey and her new lightsaber is wonderful. The only problem for me, yes, it is daunting to end the Skywalker saga, but then you think about Endgame and you realize, no, it's actually not impossible. You can actually hit a grand slam.
You can
with it. And when it was over, I didn't feel like, oh gosh, it's really over. At the end of Jedi, I felt it was over. At the end of Revenge of the Sith, I felt like it was really over. Mm-hmm. At this, I just felt like it was the end of a season. I really just felt like it was the end of a season.
And I have to say that me personally, I don't think any of the third films of any of the trilogies have completely knocked it out of the park. You know,
think Revenge of the Sith did. I think that's Shakespearean.
Well, but that's the thing. I my problem is I once had, I can't tell you the storyboard artist, but he had been hired by Lucasfilm to board. And there were so many different versions of the end of the Revenge of the Sith, but he talked about, you know, there was this, I always had in my head the image that he described of, Obi-Wan delivering the baby to Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, but the scene that you don't get to see is, you know, literally Ben destroying his ship and putting on, the cowl of the robe that we see him in the movie, cool. And disappearing into a sandstorm. You know, the notion of that he's stepping away, he's going to hide. And it was, and that was the thing. I mean, I'm sorry that, you know, that's the danger of when you talk to these people and they sit there and they're so enthusiastic about what they do. He described it so vividly. It's like, oh man, I can't wait to see that in the movie. And when it just ended on, you know, Beru and Owen with the baby and the sons, is like, oh. But
wow. Well, maybe that's how the Disney Plus Obi-Wan series will end.
That could well be.
That'd be pretty cool.
Well, and speaking of which, folks, that's also gearing up production. So this will be something that Dan and I will be talking about, you know, further as we head into 2020. But until we do, we get the next looking at Lucasfilm out the door here, folks. Dan, where else can they find you online now? Because again, you've just done an interesting repositioning of the whole, what is it, the Dan Z Media Empire, right?
Yeah. I've got a new business venture. It is danzmedia.com. It is mm-hmm. where if you are starting a podcast or a blog, or you have one and you just want to help find ways to build your brand, you can certainly contact me. Happy to set up a consultation. I'm also doing a lot more public speaking, which is one of my great loves. So whether you have want to motivate your school, your students, your teachers, your administrators, corporates, executives, whatever you want to do, I'm happy to come out and speak to anybody about different things. I've got about 6 or 7 talks out there that you can check out. And of course, you can find me on Coffee with Kenobi each and every week. We certainly are talking a lot about The Rise of Skywalker, as well as The Mandalorian, doing a lot of live events, especially recently. And we have a Patreon page where you can hear an exclusive weekly podcast where we look at popular culture.
Wow. That's an intriguing thing you've got up out of the ground there. We're going to be interesting to see what happens there.
Thank you. You just sound like the Emperor at the end of episode one to Anakin. We're watching your career with great interest.
I hope I get a better skin tone.
You do. You're much more trustworthy and good.
That's your mistake, Dan. Okay. All right. And over here at Jim Hill Media, we have a bunch of podcasts as well. We've got Disney Dish with Lynn Testo. We've got Fine Tuning with an interesting character, Drew Taylor. Mm-hmm. We have Universal Joint with Dustin Fuse. We have the Marvel Us Disney with Aaron Adams, where we talk about everything that's going on with Marvel. And we just recorded it, a brand new episode of I Want That with Michelle Valladolid. It'll be out there. So tell you what, folks, if you could do a favor for Dan and myself, if you get over to iTunes and rate and recommend not only this show, but also Coffee with Kenobi, that would be very helpful. And if you like what you heard here tonight, if you want to head over to Bandcamp and subscribe, well, that's what makes it possible to buy copies of The Art of Star Wars Rebels. So, you know, we'll be talking about that one in a further show. But I guess for now, Dan, I guess I'll see you in line, you know, when we both go, you to see, you know, Rise of Skywalker for the fifth time and me for number two. So
I love it. I'll get the popcorn.
Okay, cool. Till then, folks, you folks take care. All right.